You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, truckers are a part of a new line of defense against human trafficking. We look at a new initiative that's helping to combat that growing problem. First, this summer, the EPA issued a draft ecological risk assessment of atrazine, a type of weed killer that's sprayed on crops, especially cornfields. Some research is showing that this weed killer, even in lower concentrations, could be linked to health problems like cancer, and it could harm wildlife. But raising limitations on atrazine has also raised concern among some Wisconsin farm groups who've been using it for the last 50 years. A lot of farmers depend on it to improve crop yields and to control stubborn weeds. Jim Zimmerman joins us now. He's a corn grower from Rosendale and a director for the Wisconsin Corn Promotion Board. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you, Veronica.
Well, Jim, why do you think that limits on the chemical atrazine would impact the farming industry?
Well, reducing the limits beyond what they are would essentially, pretty much put it down to a level that would hardly make the product effective or worthwhile to a grower to go out there and actually utilize.
And I understand that crop prices are already low right now. Do you think this would have a negative impact on the yield of the corn, for instance?
Yes, that's part of the equation. And, we as growers, we have a limited number of products that we can use to be able to protect our crop. And any time that we remove one of those products, we are at risk. We're at risk both in crop production and also, because of the increase of weeds. And then, having to also use other crop or other crop protection products that are that could develop, a resistance too, because we're focusing or concentrating our use on those. So it comes in many different forms and fashion as far as about how it's going to affect the individual grower and the bottom line. But there's been several studies done as to what the net effect would be as far as eliminating the use of atrazine and as one of those tools that we can utilize. And it is talked about particularly from a weed resistance standpoint, being able to make some of the products that we utilize right now much more effective. Atrazine is one of the most effective products as far as controlling those weed resistant varieties that are out there. Anything that we can do to manage that, the better off we are, and the more effective we can be.
Is there another chemical or herbicide that could take the place of atrazine? You said it's effective, but is there anything else that could step in to bridge the gap?
Well, and that gets to the point of where we start putting reliance on less modes of action with different products. And atrazine has a mode of action unto itself.
What does that mean, a mode of action?
In the way that it controls the weeds. And some different products control the weeds from the root zone or different receptors within the plant. And when you start using different modes of action, then it's less likely to find a resistant varieties or escapes that would proliferate on you. And so the more modes of action that you use, the less likely you're going to develop or propagate or have weeds that are specific and develop a resistance to that particular mode.
We're talking right now with Jim Zimmerman, corn grower from Rosendale and director of the Wisconsin Corn Promotion Board, and we're talking about proposed limits from the EPA on the chemical atrazine. And Jim, the State Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection has said that atrazine doesn't cause immediate sickness, but that people who are consistently exposed to it over periods of time could develop reproductive and cardiovascular problems, and it could also harm fish and birds and amphibians. Cancer is one of the diseases that has been linked to it. So why aren't those convincing reasons to look elsewhere for a weed killer?
And when when we look at the information that's brought forward and look at the studies that are done, a lot of them have been very flawed, and that they aren't science that can be replicated and that that would be peer-reviewed. So a lot of those concerns are not actually what we would understand to be real. And you know, the EPA has, in the past, has done a very good job and as far as determining, setting the limits and controlling the use of products, the timing and whatnot. So, and there is that process by which, you know, they have already gone through the review processes and look at all of the documentation that's been done over the 50 years of its use and all the different scientific advisory panels that have been conducted on the use of atrazine, whether they're looking at it from many different environmental or ecological aspects. And they, you know, they, and I can only say there's been thousands of them that would show that atrazine does not pose a risk, you know, to the environment.
Well, if the science, as you see it, is shaky, why do you think the EPA is proceeding with these proposed limits on atrazine if they don't think the science is sound and they disagree?
Well, and that's my question, and that's what we are wondering, and why would they ignore all the past studies? You know, there's so many rich, large volumes of studies that that have been done, and again, there's, you know, in 2012 there was five different scientific advisory panels that talked about what risks there were associated with atrazine and what wasn't, and that has always advised that that atrazine is a product that is safe.
And one concern we haven't touched on yet is atrazine getting into drinking water, especially people who have private wells. And we know that this increased exposure, according to some science, and you may disagree with that science, but some science shows that this continuous exposure can result in long-term health consequences that are dangerous, things like cancer, for instance. So what kind of regulations do you think would need to be in place to keep atrazine from getting into people's water source?
Well, and that's what EPA does and has been doing since the beginning of the use of the product. And that is the direction that we as growers always follow. And my point is that through the 50 years of safe use of this product, that we have all been operating under, you know, those safe guidelines as put forth by EPA.
Is there evidence of atrazine getting into these private wells?
There has been some areas within the state in which there were some wells that showed an amount of atrazine getting into them. And that was done, I think that was done many, many, many years ago here within the state. And there are a few prohibition areas which we're working with UW Extension to, you know, see about what new rates could be used in those prohibition areas, as they have now fallen back from the levels of concern before.
And Jim, as we wrap up, a group of farm groups, including yours, they've been asked to contact the EPA and urge them to change their position. What kind of response have you gotten?
Well, we've gotten a very good response here this summer, and I know we probably exceeded over 10,000 different growers that have sent responses back to EPA to let them know that we've been utilizing this product in a safe, responsible way in the last 50 years, and it's done an awful lot in regards for us as far as being able to move into more conservation-type tillage practices and whatnot to be able to better conserve our soil.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much, Veronica.
That was Jim Zimmerman. He's a corn grower from Rosendale and a director of the Wisconsin Corn Promotion Board. And he was with us there talking about why he hopes the EPA will rethink its proposed limits on the chemical atrazine. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up today, President Obama gave his final address to the United Nations General Assembly. We'll talk to a political scientist about how the speech went and how historians might remember President Obama's foreign policy initiatives. First, there are more than 3.5 million truckers on America's roads, which makes them a great resource for groups working to fight human trafficking. Here are truck drivers sharing candidly their disturbing encounters with underage children who were being trafficked.
My son and I were driving through Oklahoma City, had the radio on, and the guy comes on the radio, "Hey, anybody want any underage girls?"
One of the things that we saw that disturbed us quite a bit was seeing a van pull up with a woman driving, five or six girls that got out. It looked like they ranged anywhere from 15, 16, maybe 18 years old, but all of them very, very young.
This one, she didn't even look 13, 14 years old. She had no shoes on. She had a little mini skirt on.
She couldn't have been more than 14, 15 years old.
She probably looked in her 14, 15 years old. I really couldn't tell her age, but she was very young.
And I know good and well a 14-year-old, 15-year-old is not doing this on her own accord.
Truckers Against Trafficking is opening up a new line of defense against human traffickers by mobilizing truckers, truck stop employees, and the general public to help root out the growing problem. Lynn Thompson is with us now. She's the co-founder and communications specialist for Truckers Against Trafficking. Lynn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Veronica. It's very good to be with you.
Well, where did the initial idea for Truckers Against Trafficking come from?
Well, I had grown up in El Paso, Texas, where my parents owned a small motel, and truckers were one of our main customer bases. And my daughters and I have four daughters, and the five of us, along with a friend, had started an organization to fight issues of injustice and specializing in human trafficking. And pictures from my childhood came into my mind, and I thought, you know what? There are over 7 million people total in the trucking industry across the United States. They travel. We're all localized. If we could train them to understand what human trafficking is and what to do when they see it, they could play a critical role in the fight against human trafficking across this country. So I started TAT initially as an initiative of the organization that we already had. In 2 years, it had grown so large that I was working full-time at the time, and it was too much for me to handle by myself with that job, so I turned it over to one of my daughters to run, and she took it through a 501c3 process, and it has continued to grow from there.
Was part of the problem knowing what to look for? As I understand it, trafficking looks different depending on where you find it. If you find it on the street, in a house, in a motel, the highways along rest stops, it's going to look different. So how did you figure out what to train people in?
Well, what we wanted them to do was first of all, to quit seeing young girls or young boys that were coming to their trucks or finding them at rest stops or finding them at motels or whatever, to quit seeing them as prostitutes and begin seeing them as potential victims. And then learn how to ask them questions. Do you know where you're at? When's the last time you saw your family? Do you have identification papers? Where do you go to school? And if they were foggy on those kinds of answers or were crying, if they looked scared, if they were dressed inappropriately, and if they suspected that these were victims, then they needed to make a call to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. So first we trained them on what to look for so that they were able to recognize it. Did these people have tattoos that were indicated being property of someone? Did they have bruises? All of these different things so that they could recognize it and then make the call.
And was that a switch in perception that did need to happen initially, that these were not prostitutes but these were victims? Did that switch happen easily?
It's still in the process of happening. I think that oftentimes they had seen young people out there, and they were being bothered at night. Many of them had signs on their doors that they didn't want to be bothered. And we wanted them to begin to see these kids, as I say, as victims, so we wanted them to be willing to be bothered so that they could ascertain if they were victims and make the call so they could get help. And they were more than willing to do that once they understood that these kids were being forced to do what they were doing.
I'm wondering about how this works. So if you're a trucker and you're pulled off overnight at a truck stop and you get one of these knocks on your cab door and you suspect trafficking, what do you do? Is there a tense situation where you have to try to sort of shield this child while you wait for help to come?
Well, sometimes, in the first place, we give them all a wallet card that they can carry that has critical information that they need to take down data when they go to report, but also questions to ask and things to look for. So sometimes they may get a knock on their door and they can actually ask the questions. Other times they may see something. For instance, a driver that we gave a huge award to last year, Kevin Kimmel, was resting at a rest stop or a truck stop after delivering his load. He saw a van with blacked out windows and an RV pull in the back by trucks, and he thought, gosh, that's a little weird. Then he saw men getting out of the back of that RV, going into the store, coming back out, knocking on the door of the RV, and then going in. He thought that was even weirder. Then he saw a young girl's face against one of those windows just for a second. It was pulled back, and the RV started rocking. He thought all of that was way too weird, so he made the call. Police were out there in about 5 minutes. This girl had been kidnapped 2 weeks earlier in Iowa. She was being sold on Backpage by the kidnappers all across the country as they were traveling. Kevin happened to be in Virginia at the time that he made the call and saw her. So it can look different ways, different times. They could be in a motel or a rest stop and see somebody pull up with three or four girls in a car and one guy. And before they even get out, they could just watch what's going on in that car. And then if the girls get out and start going to trucks, they can call right then before they've even made contact, recognizing that those girls are probably being trafficked. One trucker saw a guy taking a young girl into the shower area at a travel plaza, and he didn't think that looked right. He followed them in there and then made the call. So there are different ways that it looks, but we want them to be on the lookout for situations that don't look right. And then sometimes the trafficker will proposition the driver themselves. We had a driver who was propositioned at a traffic light, and he turned the guy down, but he followed the trafficker. And when he pulled into a place, then he took down his license plate number and all the information about the car and the people in it, and he made the call.
Lynn Thompson's with us right now, co-founder and communications specialist for Truckers Against Trafficking. And Lynn, listening to these stories, story after story, I mean, it strikes me, I mean, these truckers are moving around, but a lot of us travel, a lot of us use the interstates and the rest stops. Is this something everybody should be on the lookout for?
Absolutely. I think the more people that are aware that this could be happening and they could be seeing it, the more opportunities there are for raising an alarm and helping someone escape or be recovered from a trafficker. Traffickers are moving their victims across the United States all the time. That's what made drivers especially so important to us, because they're traveling all over the United States and they're trained to be observant. So why not use that as part of their daily work to understand what they're seeing in these types of cases? But yes, everyone needs to be aware.
How big a problem is human trafficking in the grand scope of things in this country?
Yeah, it happens in all 50 states. The NCMEC, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, says that one in six runaways in 2014 were likely trafficking victims. There are globally 21 million victims, and 26% of those are children. It's a $150 billion profit industry. So it is huge.
So you started Truckers Against Trafficking. Are there other arenas similar to this that you might be looking at next? I remember hearing about how airlines could partner to stop trafficking during Super Bowl airline travel. Are there other areas like that that you're looking at next?
Yeah, the transportation industry overall is a major one for training. Airlines, in some cases, are already training their pilots and flight attendants to recognize traffickers and victims when they see them, and this has occurred on several occasions where victims have been recovered. Buses and taxis all need to be trained. One of the major recruiting places for traffickers is bus depots. So if bus drivers and personnel working in the bus depots are trained, they can be alert. If people who clean up in all areas, whether it's airports or bus terminals or taxi areas, if they can all be trained and vendors can all be trained, they can recognize traffickers and victims when they're walking past them. They kind of melt into the background. Nobody really sees them, but they can recognize and see what's happening from the people that are going past them.
And Lynn, just briefly, we've just got a little bit of time left, but for people who are listening and want to help, you can't train us completely, but what should we look for to help?
I think you want to see if there are kids who all of a sudden something's different, or they're not there, or they don't seem to be as available, if they're looking scared, if they're dressing more inappropriately than ever, if you're out someplace to a sporting event or a motel or a hotel for a convention, and you see a guy there with several girls, and maybe they call him daddy, but there's no way they look like they're related. Or you hear somebody talking about a quota, or he's there with them at a hotel and there's no luggage. Those are the kind of things that would make me very suspicious, and I'd make the call. If you have a chance to talk to someone you think is a victim, you want to ask them questions about do they have their any identification papers. When's the last time they saw their parents? Do they know where they are? Because a lot of times they don't.
Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
That was Lynn Thompson, co-founder and communication specialist for Truckers Against Trafficking. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 7 tonight, it's Latino USA. Tonight, the show follows the journey of one quinceañera, Haley Alexis, from Whittier, California, as she plans for the big day. That's tonight at 7 o'clock on Latino USA. First, earlier today, President Obama gave his final speech to the United Nations General Assembly. In the speech, he told world leaders that there's been a lot of progress over the last 8 years, particularly with globalization, but that globalization has also led to tensions between nations and between governments and the people.
I believe that at this moment, we all face a choice. We can choose to press forward with a better model of cooperation and integration, or we can retreat into a world sharply divided and ultimately in conflict along age-old lines of nation and tribe and race and religion.
Andrew Kidd joins us now to break down the president's speech. He is a professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, listening back to this speech from earlier today, what themes jumped out at you?
Well, it's a more somber speech than some of the earlier ones that he delivered. There's a little bit less optimism. It's more chastened by experience, which I think stands to reason, given that the progress he might have hoped for hasn't been as forthcoming as he would have liked. As you saw in that clip, the opening clip, a big theme of it was sort of reaching out and connection and globalization and trade versus the forces that are opposed to that, more nationalist, isolationist, anti-immigration sorts of forces. And he's obviously referring in part to the U.S. presidential campaign that's going on right now, but it's also in other countries in the world. You find this in Europe with a lot of anti-EU sentiment, a lot of anti-refugee sentiment, And you find it in other regions of the world as well. And he's just articulating that divide and trying to line up on the side of maintaining connection, maintaining exchange, but trying to manage it in a more in a way that sort of reduces the downsides that a lot of people are feeling from it.
Now, in that speech, President Obama outlined a growing contest, as you said, between authoritarianism and liberalism right now. And you said some of this language is a commentary on the election cycle, but he didn't seem to directly reference the election or name Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton by name, at least that I heard. Why do you think that was?
Why didn't he name them directly? Well, this is a speech at the UN. He doesn't want to get down into the muck of a presidential campaign that's pretty mucky at this point. So I think he wants to take the high road there. In addition, it's an international audience, and it's true that these sorts of debates and issues are being seen all over the world in one form or another. So I think he's trying to keep it at a more general level in that regard.
Another aspect of the speech, he laid out a few things he said world leaders needed to work on, essentially saying that in some areas they needed to do better.
We all have to do better as leaders in tamping down rather than encouraging a notion of identity that leads us to diminish others.
And what do you think the president is getting at with that, tamping down a notion of identity that leads us to diminish others? What is he saying?
Well, I mean, one thing that was that kind of struck me about the speech, actually, is that he makes some pretty pointed remarks about the Middle East and about the role of fundamentalist or extremist Islam, really directly criticizing extremism in that context, talking about how there are places where the public sphere has been shut down outside of the mosque and we have too much fundamentalist Islam being directed in a negative sense towards other religions, other peoples. So that was actually one theme that was there in the speech. I think that was the most prevalent one. And I think he's frustrated by what has gone on in the Middle East, and he feels that he and other people, of course, had a lot of hopes for what might happen in the region with the Arab Spring. Those hopes are more or less dashed at this point, in some cases very severely dashed, of course, in Syria and in Libya, and even in Egypt. And I think he feels partly responsible for that, but as he tried to point out at one point towards the end, that there are limits to what the United States can do, and really it's in the hands of countries in the region to try to chart their own course in terms of the ideas or the philosophies that are going to be represented and sort of advanced in that region.
And in general, looking at this speech, looking back over the last 8 years, what kind of foreign policy legacy do you see the president leaving once he leaves the office?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, he, of course, came into office hoping that he would be able to mend fences with countries that had bad relations with the previous administration under George W. Bush, and hoping that he could tackle problems that the Bush administration had not been able to solve. And he made progress in some ways, but in some cases there's been progress and subsequent regress. Relations with Russia actually improved in the first half of the Obama administration, although we don't think about that much these days. There was an arms control treaty that was signed, and relations with Obama and Medvedev, who was the president at that time, seemed reasonably good. Only to have that progress fall apart subsequently as Putin came back in and then go sharply negative once, of course, the Ukrainian revolution took place and overthrew the Putin ally who was in charge of Ukraine at that point, and subsequent invasion of Crimea and eastern Ukraine by Russia. So things were actually much better at one point, but then that proved to be short-lived. He made some progress on climate negotiations, fairly recently getting even China to agree to limit its output of industrial gases that are resulting in global warming. So that's something he can point to. And on the Middle East side, his ambition, of course, was to wrap up the wars, to get out of Afghanistan and to get out of Iraq. And he did that in Iraq, and subsequently things went sharply downhill, and we had a return to civil war in Iraq and the rise of the Islamic State. With the Arab Spring, of course, the Syrian state started weakening, and the Islamic State took hold in Syria and then came back into Iraq and became the menace that it has been over the past several years. So things really didn't go well in that regard, to put it mildly. They've gone extremely badly. And even in Afghanistan, he tried to repeat what the Bush administration had done in terms of a surge to try to end the civil war there in a definitive way, and made some progress, but didn't really quite achieve the results that he had hoped for. And so it's been very difficult to disentangle there as well. So in that regard, he's really had a hard time trying to achieve even the limited goal of trying to extract the United States from what he would certainly characterize as mistakes of the previous administration.
We're talking with Andy Kidd right now from UW-Madison's Department of Political Science, talking about President Obama's last address as a sitting president to the UN General Assembly. And Andy, we're talking about a number of initiatives there that were begun one way and finished a different way, didn't exactly finish according to the president's plan. Are there things that you could point to and say, in particular, these things have been successful? You mentioned the Paris Accord looking to lean in that direction so far. Anything else?
Yes. Well, that's the interesting aspect, that there's two things you could point to as sort of high-profile successes. I would say that in the background, the gloom and doom is perhaps overly drawn. There has been progress in many areas of the world, as he mentioned. It isn't always highly visible, dramatic events, but there has been a general continuation of the progress towards democracy and economic development and such. But in terms of high-profile initiatives, yes, the two big ones you could point to, the Paris Accords on global warming and the Iran nuclear deal, really. And the interesting thing about them is that the jury is in some sense still out as to whether they're going to be successful. The Iran deal, it's about a year old now, seems to be still operating. We have pretty good verification of what's going on inside Iran. However, the deal is still very much subject to political backsliding, both on the Iranian side and on the U.S. side. The Republican candidates were practically unanimous in saying that they would reject the Iran deal, try to renegotiate it at the very least, certainly put it in jeopardy, if not abandon it on day one, and some of them claimed that they would. So if Donald Trump, for instance, were to win the presidency, it's unclear what would happen to that deal. It's unclear what will happen to that deal based on the vagaries of Iranian politics. If they have a turn towards the hard line for any number of reasons, it's conceivable that the deal could fall apart because of that. So it does seem to be working. It's very ambitious. It's well worth trying, but it may not ultimately solve the problem.
Andy Kidd stays with us now from UW-Madison's Department of Political Science, and we're looking at the president's last address to the UN General Assembly that happened earlier today. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think President Obama's foreign policy legacy will be? And what do you think of his speech today at the UN? Do you think the United States should welcome more refugees into the country? That's a topic the president talked about today. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll get to your calls and continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now with political scientist Andrew Kidd about President Obama's speech at the UN General Assembly today, the last time he addresses that particular group as a U.S. president. And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. As the president's final term comes to an end, how do you think history will remember him, particularly in the area of foreign policy? What do you think that legacy will be? And how do you think future analysts will rate his foreign policy initiatives? What about that speech today? You can call us at 800-642-1234, and you can also share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, in the speech today, President Obama said that America has been a rare superpower that acts above self-interest, and he goes on to say this.
That while we've made our share of mistakes over these last 25 years, I've acknowledged some, we have strived, sometimes at great sacrifice, to align better our actions with our ideals. And as a consequence, I believe we have been a force for good.
America has been a force for good. Do you think that is a sentiment that is shared by other world leaders and allies?
Well, some other world leaders, of course, and some would beg to differ, I'm sure. But look, I think what Obama is saying is the United States over the past 20 years or so since the end of the Cold War has had, 25 years, has had an unprecedented level of power in the world. There's no really obvious forerunner for the amount of difference, in a sense, between American military power and even economic power and those of the nearest competitor. So it's been what people call a unipolar world, where the United States is the unipole. There's no longer bipolarity, much less multipolarity. Now, we may be seeing that era coming to a close, but the thing that's going to bring that to a close is the rise of China. But that's still in the long run, at least in the medium run, like 10 or 20 years. They're not a competitor yet. The military likes to call them China and Russia near peer competitors, but not actual peer competitors yet. And given that amount of power, like most states with that amount of power have really used it, right? Most states use just about all the power they've got to annex territory or install puppet regimes or basically to run a fairly tight ship and control what's going on. And the United States has been much less dominant in that sense, much more willing to still work through international institutions that were founded during the Cold War, such as NATO, such as the United Nations itself, much more hesitant to try to impose their will directly via military power in many parts of the world. So I think that's basically true. Now, of course, there are exceptions, right? And the Middle East is a huge exception. And the George W. Bush administration's policy, especially in the early years, was the big exception. And 9/11, of course, was a very rare and unusual event that directly precipitated the U.S. Intervention in Afghanistan. The war in Iraq is much more of a war of choice. We didn't have to do it. It wasn't really related to Iran. I mean, sorry, it wasn't really related to 9/11. And many people view it in retrospect as an enormous mistake, not just because of the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction and so the original justification for the war wasn't real, but because of the whole train of consequences leading up to the rise of ISIS that we're still grappling with today. And so from a perspective of the Middle East, saying that the United States exercises its power with restraint rings a little bit hollow. Same thing could be said in Libya, where there's a dictator, Gaddafi, who had basically given up his nuclear weapons program, turned to the West, but we sided with the rebels against him anyway and helped them overthrow him, and that has led to additional years of anarchy and civil war and the rise of Islamic State franchise there. So there are cases where we have not been restrained, and some cases that were disastrously so. So it's understandable that there's some people who would criticize that. And, of course, other countries will criticize it for more self-interested reasons, like Russia and China, who simply don't want us to be exercising power in their peripheries. But more generally, certainly look at the Middle East, you could certainly be excused for taking that with a grain of salt.
And diplomacy, despite all the things you said, diplomacy seems to be have been the president's primary tool, the way he preferred to work. Do you think that legacy of diplomacy, such as it is, not always, but do you think that legacy of diplomacy is something that history will look back and say was a prudent way to proceed?
By and large, in the sense that, as Obama once said, his chief concern was to avoid doing stupid things or stupid stuff or something, some phrase like that. Again, more pointedly, avoid making mistakes on the magnitude of the Iraq War. So, yes, it's better to be diplomatic and try to achieve results through negotiations than to destroy stable regimes and unleash anarchy upon the world. That's certainly true. The big debate really is whether diplomacy, or to what extent diplomacy, needs to be backed up by the threat of force. And typically in American interactions with the world, in particular in the portions of the world where there's more instability and there are more forces certainly opposing our will, the sense has been you need to have diplomacy for sure, but you need to have the threat of force in the background. And a lot of people have been critical of him with respect to Syria, both within the State Department, in the military, for not backing up American threats with sufficient backing up American diplomacy with sufficient willingness to use force. Not that we should intervene in some full-on way, trying to overthrow the Syrian government directly, but that we should use force in more limited fashions, perhaps to break sieges, to try to punish the Assad regime for engaging in attacks upon civilians, things like that, that we could have tried to put a little bit more teeth behind our diplomatic positions, and we might get a little bit more cooperation out of actors like Russia or the Syrian regime. So I think that's the real axis of debate there.
Andrew Kidd is with us right now. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. As we look at President Obama's last speech at the UN General Assembly, and the president also mentioned refugees in his speech and the way that he hoped the world would accommodate them. Here's what he said.
Ultimately, our world will be more secure if we are prepared to help those in need and the nations who are carrying the largest burden with respect to accommodating these refugees.
Now, in the UN General Assembly, how is the influx of refugees from Syria into the rest of the world, how is that being digested in other key states?
Well, it's a very controversial issue. I think the rise, both in Europe and in the United States, of anti-immigrant sentiment is unmistakable. So in the countries of Europe, you're seeing that all the way from Greece up to Germany. Angela Merkel recently suffered an electoral loss over the immigrant issue, in part. And so I think that's something that's a very tough sell at this point. I think a more practical minded policy would be to try to, try to end the civil war. That's number one. But absent that, trying to provide for the refugees more in a place closer to where they are from, with the idea that they would go back to Syria at some point. I mean, that said, we should, of course, do our part of whatever effort is being done to try to support refugees. But it's a very difficult sell politically in the current climate.
And we leave it there. Andrew, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Andrew Kidd. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. And he was with us there talking about President Obama's final speech to the United Nations General Assembly. The president addressed the assembly earlier today. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.